Today I was invited to attend a lecture at my favorite museum, the Getty Villa, which is located in Pacific Palisades, rather than the Getty Center, which is a more famous museum located in Los Angeles. I arrived about an hour early so that I could give you a quick visual tour, hopefully inspiring you to visit if you're ever in the area. John Paul Getty was a billionaire who made most of his fortune in oil. He was named the world's richest living American in 1957 by Fortune magazine and became an avid collector of art and antiquities. A large portion of his estate was left to a trust, which is the world's wealthiest art institution, and operates this museum, whose collection includes art that spans the 7,000 years from the end of the Stone Age to the fall of the Roman Empire. On the first floor, galleries display Greek art from the Neolithic and Bronze Age, with some very rare and old objects from the Hellenistic era. Hellenistic implies the Greek period, usually between the time of Alexander the Great in 323 BC to the defeat of Cleopatra and Mark Antony in 31 BC, when Greek culture flourished, spreading through the Mediterranean and into the Near East and Asia, usually centering on Alexandria in Egypt and parts of Anatolia, which is modern Turkey. The second floor houses many fine sculptures, jewelry, glassware, mummy portraits, and many other works of art from the Roman Empire. Some of the earliest objects are Neolithic clay figurines, dating back to the 6th millennium BC, and marble vessels and figurines, dating from the Bronze Age, the historical period which was obviously characterized by the use of bronze, but also early writing and other early features of urban civilization. One of those features is archaeoastronomy, which is the study of how ancient people related the sun, moon, and stars to events on Earth. For millennia, people have been tracking cyclical patterns in the sky, noticing that certain events correspond to the repeating patterns they observed above them by celestial bodies, which they considered gods. The seasons are the best example, knowing when to plant, when to harvest, when certain rivers would flood. They would associate the pattern of nature they observed on Earth to the positioning of the planets and stars above them. Of course, the most important bodies to track were the sun and the moon, and they noticed that each day the solar and lunar positions changed slightly, and from these variations throughout the year, we get our solar and lunar calendars. While the moon can be directly observed, the sun's brightness makes it difficult, so they would observe the shadows it makes, most famously with objects such as obelisks, which is basically a large stick in the ground that casts a shadow, from which the people can determine the cardinal directions, as well as solstices and equinoxes. This can be done anywhere in the world, at any point in history, and brings us to the subject of the lecture I intended, which was called The Sun, the Moon, and the Gods in Bronze Age Anatolia. Eberhard Zanger is president of the Luwian Studies Foundation in Zurich, and an expert in the reconstruction of archaeological landscapes, and is currently focused on a site in modern-day Turkey, which in antiquity was part of the Hittite Empire. The Luwians were a group of Anatolian people whose language was part of the Indo-European or Aryan family, and whose writing was cuneiform, imported from Mesopotamia, as well as a unique native hieroglyphic script, which is also related to the Hittites as well. His presentation focused on a rock sanctuary near Hattusa, the Hittite capital, which consisted of more than 90 figures carved in stone around 1230 BC and considered one of the holiest places of the ancient Hittites. His presentation decoded the meaning of the carvings, which related to a solar and lunar calendar, something that we know people like the ancient Egyptians were aware of for the last century, but has only recently been discovered in ancient Anatolia, less than a decade ago. While some of my own personal conclusions differed from Mr. Zanger's, which I will share later in this video, I found his presentation very convincing, valuable, and enlightening, so I've included some brief excerpts here, which I'd like to play for you now.
You can see here the great temple of Hattusha, drawn in the year when it was first seen by a European scholar in 1834 by Charles Texier. And it, as it turns out, all the walls that are pointing towards us are actually astronomically aligned. They are aligned towards the sunset at summer solstice, the longest day of the year. And we know such alignments and that they existed from other places where the buildings are still intact. Here we are in Egypt, in Karnak. The Karnak Temple was erected around 2000 BC, so it's over 4,000 years old, and it's astronomically aligned to the sunrise during the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, as you can see here when this picture was taken. So there are books by experts on archaeoastronomy, and one of them that I have, I found this sentence: "Neither with Stonehenge nor with any other monument can this important day, the summer solstice, be determined." And the reason why Wolfhard Schlosser said that is because if on the longest day you look into the sun on the day before, you see no difference. It hurts your eyes, and you see no difference within a few days whether the sun has reached the northest peak and then goes back or not. That's right. But Wolfhard Schlosser has never been to my kitchen. And this is what it looks like in my kitchen a few days before the summer solstice. You can see the shadow moving in to the electrical outlets. And once it's reached the electrical outlets, it goes back. And this has worked throughout the history of the Earth, anywhere on the Earth, and it's hard to believe that people didn't notice it. Well, of course, you can say they didn't have electrical outlets back then. But they had their means of determining what's going on in nature. And there's one easy trick, for instance, how to determine the cardinal directions. You take a pole of no particular length and a rope of no particular length, and you make a circle around it. And then if it's a sunny day, you will get a shadow and it crosses the circle once in the morning and once in the afternoon. And if you connect these two lines, then you have a line going from east to west. And again, this works anywhere on Earth at any time of the year, at any time of Earth's history. And so you can determine the cardinal directions very easily. So we have four directions, but there are more. Rita has put together this beautiful panorama from the highest point of Hattusha, looking towards the east, and you can see where the sun rises during summer solstice, indicated with SS, in theory, if the horizon would be flat, and in reality, because there is a relief here. And then you can see where it is during the equinoxes, and you can see where it rises during the winter solstice. And the same, of course, applies to the sunsets. So in addition to the cardinal directions, we get four more directions for the sunrises and the sunsets. And if we look at the arrangement of the temples in the upper part of Hattusha, they look like this, and this is work that was conducted by these two astrophysicists, Cesar Gonzalez Garcia and Juan Antonio Belmonte, some years ago. They started out in Egypt, measuring the direction of the temples, and then went on to Hittite Anatolia and had altogether 61 buildings that they looked at, and they figured out that there's a very high statistic significance of the distribution. So basically, the buildings are astronomically aligned, and they figured out a way to show this in a normalized histogram in a new form, which is here looking due west, and you see the deviation from west. And there are significant peaks that have a degree of confidence higher than 99%. The tallest peak indicates the winter solstice, and the second peak the equinoctial. So this is the direction, the number of buildings pointing in that direction. And of course, as I said, they have also done this in Egypt, where you have a similar distribution, but not even quite as pronounced. So in other words, the Hittites were more oriented towards the stars than even the Egyptians. And for the Egyptians, we have known that for 100 years. For the Hittites, we are finding it out now. This is one of the pyramid bases of Yakabe. And this is the other one, which is aligned towards the sunset at winter solstice when this picture was taken last December. And then there are gates like this one, the West Gate, which is aligned at the sunset at summer solstice. And throughout the city are buildings. Here in the background, this is Temple 7, aligned to the sunset at winter solstice, even though it's not even visible from the very place where the building was erected, at least not from the lower stories. Maybe it was a tall building. So this is the kind of alignment that Gonzalez Garcia and Belmonte have recorded, and that show us that there was a celestial concern of the Hittite society. This is also sunrise during winter solstice, and you can see how some of the temples and the palace in the background catch the first sunbeams and are illuminated first. And then there are some particular chambers which are also fascinating. This one is chamber one out of two. The function was unclear, but in this time-lapse movie taken during the winter solstice, you see that during this particular day, the whole chamber is illuminated. And it very much looks like it was used during a religious service where the figure, statue of a god or goddess was placed there and illuminated. And throughout the year, you never get this effect. So it was intentionally built in the middle of nowhere, pretty much. You see it sitting there in the middle of the picture, where it would catch the sunlight during the sunset. Now, why hasn't that been recognized before? You really have to be at the right place, on the right day, at the right time, at the right weather, and with the right equipment. There is no chance that you run into this. You have to plan these things ahead and then go in the field and be lucky. This is looking from chamber one outside at the day of the winter solstice, but before sunset, and you don't see anything. So we have about 20 minutes per year when it works. So this is what I wanted to say about astronomic alignments in Hattusha. Now I'm coming to talk about the rock sanctuary of Yasilikaya. It's a limestone outcrop, about 50 by 80 meters in size, which has two chambers. On the left, hidden behind the trees, is chamber A, and the narrow gap on the right is chamber B. Unfortunately, the trees are... When you work with astronomy, you don't like trees. And artificial lighting is also not recommended. And this place is illuminated at night. So this doesn't look very special, I know, but it is absolutely spectacular. And the reason for that are these figurines. If you are not keen to being impressed by a particular site or so, this one will make a difference. You can spend several hours there. It has a certain aura. It's really fascinating. All the people who I know who've been there are fascinated by this place. You have these deities. In chamber A, there are 64 of them preserved. Altogether in the whole complex, it's over 90. And they are humans and animals and mythical figures. And there are a number of references to the stars. For instance, the person we see here on the right, the biggest, is the sun god of the heavens. And right next to him, not visible in the picture, is the moon god. And then next to that is the goddess Ishtar, which is equivalent of planet Venus. And there are stars in the reliefs and things like that. So again, there are a number of hints that this may have something to do with the sky. It is, together with Hattusha, a UNESCO World Heritage Site Here are some of the figurines. In chamber B, a group of 12 male deities, and a similar group occurs also in chamber A. Other peculiarities include these two hybrids there, which have the hindquarters and heads of a bull, but the torso and arms of a human, and they carry a bowl. And the bowl is the Luwian hieroglyphic sign for sky. And they are standing on a podium, and the podium is the Luwian hieroglyphic sign for earth. But the bowl that they are carrying in Babylonian sources is also called the boat of light. And this is the what we call climactic scene. There's a procession of people coming from the left and a procession of people from the right. The one on the left are almost all male, except for two, and the one on the right are all female. And they meet here in the middle with the two highest deities. This illustration shows it clearer. The storm god, the Hurrian storm god Teshub, and his wife Hepat. And you can see Teshub is standing on two mountain gods, and Hepat is standing on a leopard. And you can also see that their names are indicated with Luwian hieroglyphs. So many of the figures have names indicated with Luwian hieroglyphs, which helps identifying them. This one sign that looks like a belt buckle, that's the sign for deity. So it was always obvious that this is a procession of Luwian, Hittite, Hurrian deities. Not all of the inscriptions can be read because some have weathered. And then there's another thing. There is this column, difficult to see here on the right-hand side, but here's an older photo that shows it more clearly. You can see the procession of the female deities, and underneath is a column which was left there by the stonemasons, and nobody could explain why this is so, what the function of it was. The whole function of the place cannot be explained. It has been known for 130 years or so. But the excavator, the former excavator, Jürgen Seher, says many researchers have worked intensively towards an interpretation of the site, but to this day it retains much of its mystery. It is still by no means clear today what function the rock sanctuary actually fulfilled. Now, when you leave this room in half an hour, you will be able to explain every one of the 66 deities in Chamber A. And the reason for that is astrophysicists entered the scene. And what is the first thing that astrophysicists, astronomers, think of when they get into the field? It is, of course, sex. Edwin Charles Krupp is one of the most distinguished archaeoastronomers. He's visited about 2,000 archaeological sites, and he came to Yasilikaya and wrote a paper about it, suggesting that this is the place where the royal couple had sex, which is an interesting notion, hard to prove, even harder to disprove. And then the question is, of course, the frequency. During the full moons, during the solstices, or only during eclipses? But I mean, I'm not. The more I think about it, the more I think there is something to it. And that is because it was connected, it's the interpretation of the excavation archaeologists as well, to the New Year's festival. They think it's very likely that Yasilikaya was the place of the New Year festival. Our results reinforce this notion, and maybe everything gets together. Our carnival is still left over of that those celebrations. So, but we can actually reconstruct in detail what happened in Yasilikaya, and we can do that in several phases even. We start, of course, with the earliest phase around 1500 BC. We don't know what there was before that, because it's removed and overbuilt, but it may well have been that there was even earlier predecessors, simpler predecessors. So if we look at Yasilikaya or the landscape during the time of the summer solstice, Yasilikaya is on the right, the sun is setting on the left, and you see how the beams of the sun, the setting sun, stretch all across the valley until they hit the other side where Yasilikaya is. And the first building that we know of that was erected there was a gatehouse like this. And Juan Antonio Belmonte found out that this gatehouse was aligned with the sunset at summer solstice. So the light beams would have entered the building as well. He took this picture in 2009, and we went back there a few years later and documented it. And when we go in the field, the weather's always bad. And it looks, sunset looks like this, but we were lucky and we got a few minutes of sunshine, so the effect really worked. So in an architectural plan, it looks like this. You see the gatehouse and how this wall is aligned with the sunset at summer solstice. And if this applies to one of the walls, it also applies, of course, to the main axis. Now, the interesting thing about the main axis is at the rear side of the building, there were two monoliths, very big stones, and the gap between them was so small that a person cannot pass through. It was only 20 centimeters, something like that. Yeah? So, but light could pass through. And we also know that at the same time, there was a wall about 9 meters further back, perpendicular to this direction. And so what could have happened is that the sun fell through this gap, like in my kitchen, onto the wall, and the priests were marking the shadow, how it moved day by day, until it reached a certain point, and then it moved back. And if you do that carefully, you know the longest day of the year, and you have basically determined the beginning of this solar year. Very simple technique. And that was the next step, is now they started celebrating this more. It all worked out. The whole Hittite religion worked out really well. The great king became prosperous. The whole country became prosperous. They wanted to pay back their deities and build a more fancy temple. So they came up with this construction during the second phase with a big courtyard. And now the sun rays may have fallen through a window in an upper story into the courtyard where there is a pedestal. We only have that. We don't know what was sitting on top of it. But it would have illuminated whatever it was, a stone, a column, a figurine. And so when you were in the courtyard, it would have looked like this. And if you look very carefully, it gets a bit illuminated. So that means the priests, knowing what the longest day of the year is, they could have called for a service, and they have a few days to play. They have 3-4 days to play with when this works. So they could determine, they could choose a date when the weather is really nice. And so they call for a service, and magically, the statue or stone, whatever it was, becomes illuminated only once during the year when the priests have their service there. So with this, the magical power of the gods in heaven is basically passed on to their human representatives, the king and his family on earth. And this effect was actually known in architecture for millennia and used in buildings throughout Europe and even North and Central America. This is a picture from a church built in the early 18th century in Mexico, where during the equinox, you have a light beam going down the aisle of the church for a few minutes. Architects had this knowledge for centuries and kept it and erected their churches accordingly, because you get a magic moment, an epiphany, yeah, and this cannot be explained unless you know the trick, and that helped the priests to reinforce their power. And in Yasilikaya, we have a picture of the great king, a relief who paid for the construction, the final phase of the construction, Tutalia IV. And this is only illuminated during this sunset at summer solstice. So when they had this service, they would have proceeded into Chamber A and the light would have magically illuminated the king as well. And it's beautifully orchestrated because he then falls into a shadow and there's a two-minute darkness period, and then there's one isolated light beam that illuminates his cartouche. Unbelievable how this is produced. He's 2.9 meters tall, 1 meter taller than the most important deities. That comes from when you pay the bill for the construction. So it's located in chamber A, and of course in the north facing, on a north facing wall, directly facing the climactic group. And now we come, because this was part of phase three, around 1230 BC, we come to the final phase of construction under Tutalia IV, which is basically the situation today, because the Hittite civilization collapsed in 1190 BC and this rock sanctuary was left unused. And apparently very carefully cleared out. So whatever there was in terms of movable items, everything was removed. The German Institute has excavated there very carefully and there was virtually nothing left. So if you go there today, and this is what we are facing, you look like something that looks like this, not very conspicuous at all. And that's the challenge for geoarchaeologists. After 3,000 years of erosion and deposition, you don't see so much of the original Bronze Age landscape anymore. But there's one thing that's remarkable here. In the foreground is a stone that has a bowl-shaped depression, 28 centimeters in diameter. And that plays a major role in the smallest project in experimental archaeology ever conducted, which you will see right now. It's connected to the final phase of buildings in 1230 BC, indicated in red here. And as you can see, the angles between the buildings are strange. They don't seem to be make much sense unless you look at the direction of the solstices, sunsets at solstices. So the first building is directed towards the sunset at summer solstice, and the last building, the one in red now, is directed at the sunset at the winter solstice. And so this explains the angles. And the last one, winter solstice in red, is the sunbeams are running towards this rock, bedrock, that has the bowl in it. So if you look at this today, it looks not very exciting. You see this particular wall here, straight towards this limestone knoll, and the place where the bowl is still in the shadow here. Now this is our experiment. We bought a salad dish at IKEA, 28 centimeters in diameter, and filled it completely with water to show the reflections of the sun on this little surface. And this is of course the day of the winter solstice in the afternoon. You can see how the sun sets, and the beam that is a little after 6 o'clock now is going along that wall and hitting our dish. And you can get all kinds of nice effects with this. And now imagine that this would have been a major pond around this stone. So that's all pretty easy. But of course, the main reason why you are here is because you want to know what the purpose of those reliefs is in chamber A. And that's the final part already of my talk. The purpose of the reliefs is to keep track of the days and the months and the years. So this is chamber A again, an open court in a limestone, natural limestone outcrop about 30 meters long, with 64 preserved deities. King Tutalia here on the right, the climactic group in the center, the male deities on the left. And we think that this is a calendar. Now, how would it have worked at a calendar? Let's look at a bit for a moment at the theory of how a calendar would have worked a few thousand years ago. Of course, the people were very much aware of the natural rhythms. For instance, the rhythm of the moon, the lunar months, 29 or 30 days, from one lunar phase to the next lunar phase. And then, of course, there is the rhythm of the year. They could feel the seasons. This is repeating itself, and it's not just the seasons. Of course, it's important for sowing, it's important for harvest. The river floods are connected to the seasons. There are two types of natural rhythms, and they made people believe that everything is driven by celestial forces. Now, today we know, of course, 1 year is the time it takes for the Earth to complete one orbit around the Sun. We celebrate that on New Year's Eve. Imagine two aliens watching us. One says, what are they doing? Celebrating that their planet completed one orbit around their sun. I told you, they're not very smart. And this is only what we know for the past 400 years. Before that, people knew what a year is, but they didn't know that it is the Earth going around the sun. So how would they know what a year is? Well, they knew it from the points where the stars rise. Of course, they rise in a different place. Every day, they move 1 degree, which is why the circle has 360 degrees. The Babylonians kept it a bit more simple. And so after 1 year, the stars rise in the very same place again. And because of these connections of the star rising with the seasons and with the floods and everything, the people had the feeling that everything is governed by celestial forces. But they had to figure out the rhythms behind it to come to grips with it. And they are not related. The lunar months are not related to the solar years. If we look at the lunar months in a schematic drawing, so we get the new moon when the Earth, the moon, and the sun are aligned. And then it takes 29 or 30 days, 27 or 28 days for the sidereal month, and then 29 or 30 days for the end of the synodic month, and until the same lunar phase has been reached. Our months today have nothing to do with celestial parameters. But back in those days, they were calculating the months by lunar phases. And this is the theory how it worked. They had to look for the smallest common denominator that would work for days and months, lunar months and years. Now, if you take 12 lunar months of 29 or 30 days each, you end up with 354 days per year. But the years, of course, 11 years longer. So it works, but it doesn't work really well. It only works when you are calculating the lunar months, and every 2 or 3 years, see that down below, for 19 years, you add one intercalary month. Yeah? And if you do that over a period of 19 years, you add 7 months, doesn't matter when. In the end, the two are more or less synchronous. The difference is 2 hours. Yeah? So this is the smallest common denominator between lunar months and years, is 19 years. It was then equivalent to 235 lunar months, or 6,940 days. And then the whole circle and system starts all over again. And if we look now as Yasilikaya, we have the male figures on the left side of chamber A, here with the two bullmen, and the main scene in due north. And we have the female figurines on the right side with this column pretty much in the middle. And then the question is, what do we make out of this? And we decided, after much thinking, why not put them all on one sheet of paper? So there are 66 deities here. 64 are preserved. Of one, we only have the inscription. And one was pretty much stolen and found again, retrieved, and is now in the museum. It's called Yekbas in here, one of the female deities. So 66 altogether. And again, we stared at this for several months, not knowing what to make out of this. And I read hundreds and thousands of pages on Hittite religion and Babylonian astronomy. I lost some weight. I can only recommend, if you want to lose weight, get an interest in Babylonian astronomy. It helps. Until I came to the point where I thought, well, why not arrange these figurines in groups? Yeah? Easy. Make groups out of them. So the first group are, of course, the 12 figurines which look identical. And this has been recognized by Juan Antonio Belmonte in 1990, he tells me. He's published it in 2000, that the 12 male deities that look identical are indicative of the lunar months. Then we have the climactic group, which is by itself defined. And then it's pretty easy. To the right of that, you have the female deities indicated in red here, and then all the rest in between. So there are four main groups. Now, what have we achieved? A little bit. And then it took more weeks of thinking and thinking until I got to the point that why not count them? 12 in the first group, 30 in the next group, 5 in the main group, and 19 female deities. And these are numbers which are almost like Fibonacci numbers to an astronomer. When he sees a sequence like that, they say, yeah, of course, it's clear what it is. Yeah. And I show you how it works. This is a schematic drawing of all the deities in Chamber A. Here are the 12 male deities for the lunar months. They were counted from right to left because the moon is moving from right to left. They are heading towards the right. And Luwian hieroglyphic is always running counter to the direction of the figures. So if they are facing in one direction, the reading direction is in the opposite direction. And here we have the 30 days counting from the right to the left. So the first day of the month is the first visibility of the lunar crescent. That marks the beginning of the month. And then every full moon coincides with the day where that's equivalent to the two bullmen. So symbolically, they are carrying the full moon in their bowl. And the last day of the new moon is the 29th or 30th figure. And on the right side, we have the solar years counting from left to right now, against the direction that they are facing. And this is called, amongst astronomers, Ennea Decaeteris. It's actually the metonic cycle that was described by the Greek astronomer Meton much later, of course. And the marker is probably set to establish a second annual cycle of 8 years. That also exists, it's called Octaetris, but it could also have been a cycle of Venus or something else. So there were two periods for the years. And if we take 19 solar years here, this is equivalent to 228 lunar months plus 7 intercalary months, and equivalent to 690-40 days. And the average deviation per year between the lunar months and the solar years is 6 minutes, 6.5 minutes. So in 19 years, it's a little over 2 hours. And so this is how the system could have been easily used as a lunisolar calendar and could indeed be used as such today. It works in perpetuity. Now, we asked an artist to reconstruct what the Chamber A may have looked like, and it's somewhat like this. This is Rosemary Robertson who produced that. She worked on this for 7 months, and she has 40 years of experience with frescoes and late Bronze Age wall paintings. And if night falls, it looks a bit like this. This is the sky at midnight. During the summer solstice in 12,050 BC, Rita calculated. This was a ceremonial house for a number of religious festivals, including the New Year festival. And it's by no means as isolated a find as people have thought so far, because, for instance, in Carchemish, in the 7th century BC, these small figurines, they are only 2 centimeters tall, were found, and they are absolutely identical with those from Yasilikaya. So here we are 500 years later in Syria, and we have a trace of the same system. It could have been that this was a calendar that was widely used and used for a long time. We also have similar records from Egypt. This is the publication of Napoleon's expedition to Egypt, reconstruction of the engravings on the Temple of Edfu, built during the 2nd century BC, so it's Hellenistic. And in here we have 30 deities to mark the 30 days of the lunar months with their individual names. And then we have 12 deities for the lunar months, and then three superior deities. So this is in Egypt 1,000 years after Yasilikaya went out of use. A very similar system. The first excavator of Hattusha was Hugo Winkler, and he started this excavation in 1906. And in the same year, he published a book in which he said, in principle, calculating the year means equalizing the circulation of the moon and the sun. The whole mechanism goes back to much earlier times than all our knowledge of history, that is beyond 3000 BC. And this publication launched a major scholarly fight, which was later dubbed Pan-Babylonism, because he said much of our culture, and in particular our religions, is derived from Babylonia and was based on celestial concerns. And he was fought at the time by the established scholars, who were for the most part Jesuit priests and didn't like these ideas. But it now turns out that Hugo Winkler was apparently very much ahead of his time.
So when comparing the lunar and solar calendars, they don't line up. In other words, the lunar months are not related to the solar years. The problem with the lunar calendar is that it drifts away from the seasons. Each year, the start and end dates of each month drift by 11 days. In order to stay correct, every lunar calendar has to deal with this drift away from the calendar year. After 12 lunar months, you have 354 days. This is short of the 365 days that it takes the Earth to orbit the Sun. To make the calendar work, they added a leap month every 2 or 3 years, allowing the lunar and solar cycles to coincide every 19 years. This, Mr. Zanger explains, is the reason for the depiction of the 19 deities engraved on the rock shelter. That said, in the Islamic lunar calendar, they never bothered to sync up the calendars and let them drift. It takes 33 years for the cycle of lunar years to get back to the original position. This is the true reason behind a 33rd degree in Freemasonry. As very few people know the secret Masonic connection with Islam and goddess worship, which is symbolically related to the moon, which can be understood when one looks at their symbology, such as the crescent moon of the Shriners on their fez hats, a secret society which requires one to be a master Mason to become a member. I'll be releasing a video soon on the origins of secret societies, as well as their occult rituals, so make sure to subscribe if you're interested. I don't agree with Mr. Zanger's interpretation of the 12 figures, which he attributes to phases of the moon, and states elsewhere that they're a precursor to the zodiac, as I've demonstrated, comes from Jupiter's 12-year cycle around the sun and its path along the ecliptic, traversing the constellations which make up the houses of the zodiac. I also differ with him in that he does not subscribe to transatlantic Bronze Age connections, and I do, not only through archaeoastrology, such as alignments of pyramids and other sites, but physically with the Phoenicians and via ancient copper mining in Michigan, which I propose helped fuel the Bronze Age and the Old World. Mr. Zanger also will not address Göbekli Tepe when asked after his presentation, which surprised me, as he's an expert in Anatolia, and it shares astrotheological symbology with other ancient Near East civilizations. But I'm still very grateful for his contributions to the field, And it is archaeologists like him who, through diligent work in the field, are helping to make archaeology and anthropology great again. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. You can find my published books on Amazon. Thank you to those who support me on Patreon. Your support is greatly appreciated. There should be a link below for those who are interested. I would also like to thank anyone that shares these videos, as I rely on word of mouth. Please remember to hit the like button. Don't forget to subscribe. I look forward to reading your thoughts in the comment section. Please have a wonderful week, and I hope to see you again soon.